might as well get going, I guess.
So if you've looked at Canvas, there's a folder called Files in there, and it just kind of outlines some of the, just bulleted the main points that we've covered over the last chapter one, chapter two, kind of fill in the blanks if you want, you know, give you some study guide in that sense. And then if you've, so I was hoping maybe Tim will show up here in a little bit. Today's the 11th, right? So we'll put the podcast on, but today we're basically going over those two papers. And if you haven't downloaded them from Canvas, they're also on your webpage. And so I'll put the podcast up here, but we won't have the echo because we're going over there. And then on the 13th, on Wednesday, Tim's trying to get a lab outing that we can either go to the human performance lab or another lab to see some of the equipment that's used in muscle physiology. Okay, so stay tuned. He'll probably send you a notice through Canvas. Maybe we'll just meet there. That'd probably be easiest. And if anybody's lost, we'll put a cell phone number up there to figure out where we're going. So stay tuned for the Wednesday. And then in case you're, you know, bored, there's some good music up there for you on the webpage too. All right. So that's good. Hopefully that'll help you get through the day. All right. So what we were trying to do is to go over these two papers, and this one with on Drosophila. So I just mentioned that we're on the papers, but on Canvas there's a little study guide if you want. Okay. So on the sarcomere formation and this lab that's really been active with Drosophila systems and their staining abilities that they have, but also they can make RNAi knockdowns relatively easily. So let's just go over this a bit. So, we were just talking about Wednesday. Do we have a plan yet? Or stay tuned. Okay.
Wednesday we will be in the musculoskeletal lab in Weddington Building.
Cool.
That's room 222.
222.
And we will do a force length relationship with Emily's volunteered for George Force. Force relationship with the side X force and a little more detail about interaction with actin and myosin preparation with Dr. Campbell for next week.
That'd be great. All right. Very good. Perfect. Okay, so we'll just meet there then, 8:30. All right. So a little bit, just to refresh you again, remember all the units that are part of the sarcomere, right? We can't forget everything, but they don't have the Titan listed in here, so remember there's Titan that's in here as well. So I thought we kind of went through the different models last time a bit, and the last model was about integrin signaling and how the sarcomere comes together, if we remember what the interest was there. And then the antibody staining to actually see where all these elements are and to show that the antibodies actually worked in this preparation in the Drosophila, so that they were staining up these different... Let's see, is that showing? Sorry. Extend this arm out. Does that work? There we go. So that they were using these different antibodies to look at the sarcomere bands, and looks pretty good. Also, these different proteins that are in there, zipper, Z-asp, alpha actinin, and how that might stabilize this IZI complex. Remember the Z-band and the two I's for the actin on either side. And then that integrin is a part of that interdigitation between the thin and thick filaments. So basically, they then go through to start to make different knockdowns and different staining patterns to see how these bands come together. So does anybody... Is anybody kind of wanting to go with this a bit or discuss anything on this part? Coming up with the myosin heavy chain knockdowns? So to clarify this process, I mean, just jump in if there's something that's really interesting here. They looked at these mutants with the myosin heavy chain mutants, and they lack these thick filaments, which would make sense, right? Because they're knocking down the myosin heavy chains. So what's nice is I think in the Drosophila, there's actually... one heavy myosin heavy chain gene, but that's alternatively spliced, so you can get some different parts to it, you know. So this is the way that this works, so it's a bit different than other systems. But neat to see that then the thick filaments are not there. And so that's important. And that they didn't see these IZI complexes, these proteins. They couldn't align well with the absence of the myosin heavy chain, right? So that helped it all come together. So they can't line in a nice banding pattern, right? So nice idea is to see that one leads to the other. Remember, they're trying to see how muscle develops and how these sarcomeres come together. Okay. So they also showed, right down here, so these are some of the, I think, the main take-homes. I'll just go over these, unless you have some others that you'd like to bring up, too. These myosin heavy chain, you know, complete disruption of these proteins in the myofibrils. So if this is not there, then myofibrils aren't forming properly. And let's see what, there was something interesting here I had starred. This myosin heavy chain expressed in embryonic muscle several hours to sarcomere organization. One possibility is this myosin heavy chain is required for the organization of the proteins at the later stage. To exclude this possibility, this is what's nice about the Drosophila system. They can actually do things at different stages as well. To exclude this possibility, we stain the embryos at stage 15 and 16 when many of the sarcomere proteins became enriched with the muscle attachment sites. So the removal of the myosin heavy chain had no effect on the disruption of integrin, alpha-actinin, zipin, ketin, and these other proteins at the attachment sites. So that's kind of interesting. Suggesting the formation of the muscle attachments in the myosin heavy chain is an independent process. So that's kind of neat that they would form independently. But you could look at it at these different stages during development. So maybe for maintenance of these or growing later on, that could be important. So I don't know if we have to go through all these different figures, but just to see that they can actually stain up these. And then you see this is the myosin myosin chain mutant, and we can see that the banding pattern is lost compared to the wild type, right? So wild type, they get these nice banding patterns with the different staining, integrin, merge them together, beautiful figures. Hopefully they're coming through okay there. And so that's kind of neat to see these differences and then see how that it's not forming the patterns that they would normally. Are we good there? All right. So I don't know if we need to go through all of these, but the main take-homes. I mean, here they're staining some of the banding patterns with these RNAi knockdowns now. The troponin T, they've knocked this down. The troponin C, these are RNAis, right? So they can knock down the protein expression. And then putting these all together, even the tropomyosin. So remember the tropomyosin, troponin C, troponin I, troponin T. Right, and then they can start with these, comparing these different RNAi knockdowns for the troponin T or I or C or the myosin, and you can see that the staining pattern is completely disrupted in some of these. So, some of the take-home then of these, let's see if I can get this up here. Yeah. So they stained these up with these major components, right? And they had depletion of the troponin T or I eliminated these striation patterns, indicating that both are essential for sarcomere formation. So it's kind of neat. So they both need the troponin Ts and the Is. And if we think about, let's just go back here to get the big picture. You know, these troponins that are in here, I mean, you kind of wonder why they need these, right? Let's see, that they wouldn't form the striations without those. So somehow needed to get these striation patterns. You'd think that maybe these proteins could just kind of come in there and help with the whole actin, the I bands, right? But that they actually need these, so they're integral in that part. All right. So that's kind of neat. And then they looked at a key element. One was the troponin C, right, which binds calcium, right? So they expected the knockdown of the calcium-binding protein would also affect the sarcomere organization and maybe desensitize this whole calcium response to, if they knock that down, they don't have it to be able to bind calcium. But it was kind of interesting. For example, this knockdown of the troponin C did not lead to any significant change in the myosin heavy chains or this actinin striation. So the troponin C didn't seem to be as important as the others for the striation patterns. And the take-home from their staining, if we want to look at some of their supplement figures there in their paper as well, but the take-home here was the troponin T, I, and the tropomyosin are all essential for the sarcomere formation. And they tested whether these three proteins assemble in a sequential manner into the sarcomeres as, you know, looking at other organelles. But their take-home here was that there was no loading sequence to the troponins or the tropomyosin complex during the sarcomere assembly. So it seemed like they might just kind of form together at once. So that's kind of neat. And they kind of restate that over here. Interesting. Can you see that? Yeah. Interestingly, we did not observe in the sequence of events in the recruitment of the troponins or the tropomyosin, suggesting this complex is recruited as a complex to the sarcomere. So that's kind of the take-home, that all that would come together and then just get put into the sarcomere. So neat to think about that that has to assemble somehow in that cytoplasm, right? And then get put into the whole sarcomere that's functioning. That's odd to think about. Here's a contracting muscle, right? The sarcomere is moving back and forth, and somehow this just interdigitates in there and develops and on top of all this. And then you think about growth and atrophy as well. That's really neat. Okay, so then they started looking at the myosin heavy chain in this relationship with the actin Z disc and that IZI complex. So when they depleted the actin by the RNAi, the primary muscle staining with the myosin heavy chain showed these shorter and thinner striated myofibrils, so might have some component with that then if they knock down that actin. Remember, actin's really an important part in the cell, but they actually found that there's these six different isoforms in the Drosophila and, you know, a number of different actins that you can find in the Drosophila system, in that they differ just a bit in some of the amino acids, but that these type here are in the body wall muscles. You don't have to memorize that parts, but they're trying to figure out how they actually interdigitate with the muscle as well. So I thought this was kind of interesting, that this actin turnover rate in the thin filaments, remember that actin that's in the thin filaments that makes up the muscle, 100-fold lower than that of the cytoplasmic actin filaments. So if they were staining patterns, you could think that that's protected a bit from the turnover rate inside of cells. I mean, when you stop to think about that, isn't that amazing? You think of a cell, right? A half of your cell weight is protein, right? So every cell that you have, about half of it is protein, maybe a little bit more in muscle because of all the contractile elements. But every little enzyme, every little protein has a turnover rate. You think of glycolysis only, right? And you think, oh gosh, I have all those enzymes to think about. And the mitochondria and all the proteins in the mitochondria just for energy. But then think about all the proteins that are necessary for cell division, for cell growth. The pumps, sodium-potassium pump, right? Potassium channels, voltage-gated sodium channels, calcium channels. All those proteins, they all turn over, right? And they all turn over at some rate. And how are they turning over? And how do they know to say, I'm too old, the channel's not working anymore, kind of like my brain. So you think about those proteins. You know, does anybody remember maybe from cell that some of you have like a cell biology class? How do proteins turn over in a cell? How do they know that they're maybe getting old and they need to be turned over? Anybody remember anything about that? Yes, yes, exactly. They can get ubiquitinated, or something binds to them, right? And it kind of is a signal to the cell to turn it over. And the longer it's there, then it's more likely to be ubiquitinated and then get turned over. Maybe these actin molecules that are inside of the structure, maybe they're protected from ubiquitination somewhat, you know, right? And they don't turn over as fast. But this is interesting to think about in your whole cell functioning. And then the turnover rate, is it dependent on activity? So, you know, how is all that regulated, right? And you think about slow muscle, fast muscle. Maybe there's a faster turnover in slow muscle because it's being used all the time. compared to fast muscle. But if there's an injury in there or some proteins that are damaged, you know, that turnover rate is a little bit turned up. So you wonder, how is that all regulated, right? Some people believe it has to do with the calcium regulation in the cell and that activity that's sensed by the calcium inside the cell, because most all cells, the activity is related to the calcium signals that are inside the cell, even muscle, right? Because calcium rises, muscles contract, same in neurons, same in other cells. So people think about the calcium regulation with protein turnover. Just good to think about the big picture, too, instead of just all these details. But you think about turnover rates, and important. Even like those fast-contracting muscles, right? The circa that tucks the calcium back up into the ER. You know, there's a lot of proteins in there. They're being used all the time. They got to get turned over, put back in the membrane. So it's really quite interesting to think about all that turnover rate, all that utilization, right? So just some kind of out-of-the-box thinking. So a 100-fold lower turnover rate in these actin filaments. So if somebody was staining for these particular actins that are in the sarcomere, you might see that they're hanging around a lot longer than if you were staining for maybe some of the cytoplasmic actins. So it might confuse you about turnover rates. That's kind of neat. And so they investigated the Z-line components of the alpha actinin, zipper, Z-asp, and this other protein in this organization. And they showed no significant changes in the striation pattern when monitored this myosin heavy chain staining for the alpha actinin knockdown, indicating that this alpha actinin is not required for thick filament organization. So that's kind of neat. One step at a time. Right. But they did find out something else, though. This knockdown of the zipper led to this fuzzy, but they still had some striation. So it was a little fuzzy, but they still could see the striation. So this zipper protein might have some function. Whoops, sorry. Zipper might then have some function there. So it seems generally the take home here, if these sarcomere components does not affect the initial formation of the sarcomeres. That's kind of neat. But their general staining pattern, the take home for this part was that the results suggest that the myosin can assemble into the thick filaments independent, right, of the IZI complex, but that the sarcomere structure of the myosin heavy chain filaments requires the ordered arrangement of this IZI complex. So that's kind of neat. And that goes all the way back to what we've talked about with Albert St. Georgi, that actually, you know, dissolved muscle and glycerol, and you can see that myosin units can come back together again. But actually, in the system is quite neat as well, in the functional system. Okay, is that kind of get the general picture? I know it's not maybe super exciting, but it's, you know, it's interesting to see how muscles are coming together in these different components, one after the other, of how they're utilized. Okay, then they're looking at some of these other components that we know that zipper and alpha actinin may be this tension sensor, and trying to understand more about their components. So they use these RNAi results again, and that this Z-asp is not required for the initial sarcomere assembly. Let's see, let's go to some of the main components here. They look basically this alpha actinin mutants, so they could make these mutant lines without the alpha actinin. And they found that this alpha actinin is required for the Z line coming together, this condensation, but not for the sarcomere assembly or recruitment of the other Z line proteins. Sorry. These other Z line proteins, such as the titin, the kinetin, and the Z-asp. So the Z-lines can form, but they don't all have an orderly arrangement without this alpha-actinin. So that's kind of neat. I think there was something else that was really quite interesting. Let's see. And so maybe, you know, it's helping to, these other proteins are helping to stabilize that whole Z-line disc to form. More or less, maybe bringing them together, keeping them together. Then they did look at some of the other aspects. I highlighted this. Let's see what this is about. They knocked down the PMCA. Remember, this is in the plasma membrane. So something to think about. Something to think about a little bit about Drosophila systems again, skeletal muscle. Remember, their calcium is different. It's coming into the cell. It's different than in us and mammals. They have voltage-gated calcium channels on their plasma membrane. So a lot of calcium comes in across the plasma membrane, as well as some from the ER, but not really that much. Most of it in the crustaceans and in insects is really calcium coming in from extracellular calcium, kind of like our heart, right? Calcium function. So that's kind of neat. So they were looking at this as well. And let's see, what I forgot to highlight. And anybody remember what exactly this was happening here? Oh, I see. Here it is. They maintain a relatively normal sarcomere structures when treated with these knocking down the PMCA. So that's pretty neat that it wasn't required really for the structure formation of the sarcomere. So, you know, calcium loading here. All right. And looking down at some of these other proteins, like the zipper, Z-asp, or this alpha-actinidin, given that a single knockdown of these proteins did not reveal any kind of problems, the recruitment of the sarcomere assembly, they then removed all of them together, and it led to a complete loss of the striation. So it seemed like there might be some combined effect of these for that sarcomere. So if they knocked down the individual ones, they could still see the banding pattern, but if they knocked them all down together, then it seemed to lose the striation completely. Let's see what figure 4D shows, just so we can find that. 4D. Where's 4D? 4D. So these are over here. So I guess this is it, right? Probably right here. This is the knockdown of these, and that completely gone, all the banding pattern. So kind of neat the way that they could stain up and see these. You know, we were just talking about there was a fuzziness that was occurring with some of these knockdowns, but they could still see the banding patterns. Where are we? Okay. The last part of this paper, pretty much, was that one of his interests in this lab is actually looking at integrin and the sarcomere assembly. So they know that in C. elegans, remember that's a little worm, Drosophila's mice, also have thought about this integrin pathway for sarcomere assembly. And so they started to address that in the Drosophila system. And let's see, what do we have here? And it was proposed, proposed about the assembly initiating this actin filaments at the muscle cell and the membrane, right? These, because that holds the actin and the Z-disc up to the plasma membrane of the cell, and that maybe if this was missing, then it might be a whole disruption. Okay, so they addressed this. They found that beta integrin is high expression in the muscle fibers and at the attachment sites, but relatively weak at some other sites. So the take-home of all this was the results suggest that integrins do not appear to be involved in the assembly of the IZI complex, and the myosin heavy chain is required for the integrins to align with the Z-disc. So that was quite neat. But then they looked at some of these expressions in the wild type and these null mutants, these knockdowns, at different stages, and when the myofibrils start to form. And I think there they showed that the sarcomere structures of these muscles were disrupted. So that's neat that it's necessary at different stages in the development. Okay, but the Z complex, this IZI complex could still form without the integrins. So to get it all to function with the plasma membrane and line up nicely, then it needs to be present when it's attaching to the membrane and actually keeping a nice banding pattern. Okay. So they had these little dots when they knocked it down, Z-disc proteins. So I guess they would deform, but they wouldn't line up nicely and then align with the plasma membrane in their nice pattern. So it might be maybe some attachment points on the membrane that are needed. So this is the take-home of this integrin, serve as anchor points for this floating IZI complex, and provides the tension that allows this connecting with the thin and thick filaments. So these IZI complexes form together, and then they have to attach to the membrane, right? And the integrins are important for that, and that then can sense that tension. But then if they're not allowed to do that, then they kind of have this floating proteins around these complexes without them forming nice banding patterns or coming together as the possibly the tension reception for the cell. And that might actually be very important for forming the right sarcomere, having that tension on those proteins so they can line up as well. So all that has to come together with those heads lining up just right and, you know, the nice banding patterns for every Z-disc. So how do they know to space just right? So if they have attachment points that they can bind to in the plasma membrane, then they would have that nice spacing as well instead of just mixing all over in the cell. Now, what would be interesting is to, which I haven't found a paper yet, smooth muscle is a whole other beast, right? And you don't see this nice banding pattern, but you still have myosin, you still have actin, and maybe there's, you know, it would be interesting to see where's the integrins with smooth muscle and how does that attach. Maybe that's why there's kind of a mismatch in some of that smooth muscle and the way that it contracts. So it would be an interesting comparison, I think, to look at smooth muscle and its formation and maybe seeing that anchor points are different or maybe a little bit scattered around because it's unusual. You don't see that banding pattern, but it's the same proteins involved with smooth muscle contraction. So, you know, this kind of take-home picture is pretty neat, I think. And it's always nice, whatever you're doing in your own work and research or if you read a paper, is, you know, you get a lot of text and you kind of get lost about where things might be. But it's always to make a model, a little schematic, and kind of pull it together. And then you see the step pattern to it and does it make sense to you. So I guess this is kind of a nice schematic that they have here about, you know, integrin helping to make these anchor points, like we see here, and that then can line up these Z discs, these floating IZI discs, so they could be floating around, but then when they find the anchor point, they can line up, and then these other proteins that we were just talking about help to line the Z disc together. So that's neat, and that the myosin heavy chains can form independently, but then they need to line up as well with the actin. And so all this coming together, they've kind of made this little schematic, but they still have some questions about how myosin might line up nicely and, you know, what might be involved there. It's interesting to think about the titin that is throughout that whole myosin, that A band, and that's necessary to line up with the Z-disc, the IZIs. So pretty neat, and then you would get a sarcomere out of that. So we can imagine every protein in your body, right? It's made by some sequence, gene sequence, right? And any mutations, most likely you can always find a mutation out there in everybody with every protein, right? Some of those mutations then are lethal, so might not make it throughout embryogenesis. So it's interesting to think about every protein in your body. There's probably somebody out there that's had a mutation in that protein. And, you know, now I think it was a study out of Vanderbilt where they actually looked at fertilizations in humans and, you know, that your pregnancy test and all that, and that they found over 50% of fertilizations end up in spontaneous abortions. So if over 50% of human fertilizations end up in spontaneous abortions, what's the cause, right? So they've actually tried to do some of the studies that they can collect the tissue is that finding out why. And a lot of these are ion channel pathologies, like a calcium channel that doesn't develop right. Or think of a voltage-gated sodium channel that doesn't develop right. How can that cell function, or how does a heart develop in the fetus, right? And if that doesn't develop right, then the rest of the system doesn't develop right. So we begin to think about, that's pretty high. And you begin to wonder, you know, what's the reason behind it, right? And then some of them aren't so bad, right? You can function, but then if you stress yourself, you've heard of people with, you know, heart abnormalities, for example, and then they go stress themselves on the field or on the court, and then all of a sudden die because they finally have pushed themselves to that limit of some stressor that then causes that malfunction to actually manifest itself, and then they can't survive. But just think about, you know, what would happen in embryogenesis if you had a mutation that these proteins didn't develop right, in a developing fetus. You know, the heart's not developing, skeletal muscle's not developing. And you've heard of many cases, I'm sure, like floppy baby syndrome and all kinds of different aspects that you could find early on, but some of these manifestations might not occur until later. Okay, we didn't go through all these figures, I know, all the supplement figures, but I think that would probably put everybody to sleep this early in the morning. So it was just kind of give us an idea of how people could use other systems to understand potentially how we develop, and that's neat because the Drosophila offers so many advantages. As you can see, the RNAi knockdowns, you have short developmental time, you can speed it up by raising the temperature, you can slow it down by just cooling it down. So you can do a lot of manipulations that you can't do in other systems. So ideas, take home, something interesting that you all found from looking over this? Yes, no, maybe. You don't want to switch from humans to Drosophila? No, just they don't talk back to you. We had a student in the lab this summer, and we were cutting up little larval Drosophila, and you know, you're squirming around, and the student said, "Do they feel pain?" And I was just like, "Oh God, okay." Anyways, so it's not a human, don't worry about it. But anyways, I don't want to, you know, it's an animal still, but we try not to torture any creature. But I think that was an interesting discussion. Okay, they could. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's reflexive. Okay. Now, Esther DuPont Van Steeden suggested this paper, which came out recently. So this is American Journal of Physiology 2017 that just came out. And it's kind of neat because it just fits with what we talked about in a bit. Sarcomere mechanics and striated muscle from molecules to sarcomeres to cells. Did anybody have a chance to look through this? Possibly? Anything that popped out that's interesting?
I mean, this happens a lot of times, but some of these basic experiments, like what you'll see in biomedical research, is labs just not keeping their methods consistent across. And so when you look at different results and you can't figure out why, sometimes it just comes down to different labs utilizing different methods. You know, particularly with like permeabilizing fibers, just like the environment that fiber's in can really influence its contraction kinetics. And then also, if you're using human tissue, just like the innate heterogeneity between your samples of humans, human tissue is hard to get, you can have low sample size as well. But then also that you can, you know, there are some real inherent advantages to just isolating a muscle fiber, so we could all get on the same page and run the experiments the same way.
That would be great. We've made it some comments in a meeting once when we couldn't reproduce some things that were done in Australia, so the take-home was hemispheric differences, but, you know, that didn't go over very well.
And it's hard, too, I think, because for a long time there was only, like, a few labs really looking at single-fiber, like, performance or contraction kinetics, and so it's hard to discern what's a good method versus one that may not be so reliable.
Yeah. And then different instruments and finer elements like Ken has in his lab versus maybe others are a little more gross.
Right. Like how many real experts are there and reviewing the papers before they get out?
Good point. I like these new journals that are out there like eLife. I don't know if you've seen those where you publish your paper and then it's open resource, but also the reviewers are acknowledged who's reviewing it. Yeah. And then your reviewers' comments are put up there as well. And then the authors have a chance to rebuttal those reviewers' comments, and then you kind of see the dialogue that goes on through with the discussion. That journal's like really kicking right now, eLife. Little scary things too, because you might think I overlooked something, but you know, it's better to get it out there and have your own corrections than somebody else correcting it for you. So you just kind of have to suck it up sometimes, I think. So that would be good if people could point out issues like that. But then you worry about, you know, too many issues that might get pulled up, and then there's a reviewer on your NIH grant that says, "Well, look at that. They didn't do any of that right." Why should we fund that lab again? So it is putting yourself out there, isn't it? You know? But it's better for science, actually, as a whole.
I knew that on ELIFE, you could, and I think a lot of these newer journals are making it they're showing who reviewed the paper. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I didn't know you could see the dialogue.
Yes, go on through that. It's pretty neat. And then there's the other journal that came out. It's not as high of impact as eLife, but it's a Faculty of 1000. So it's the same idea. You put your paper out there. It was out of England, and they just call it Faculty of 1000 because they have like 1,000 reviewers. But they pick three reviewers out around the world on that topic, and they review it and put their comments out. And until you've addressed all their comments, do you get like the three green stars. But you might get two where they go back to the reviewers and address two of the comments, but until you've addressed it all satisfactorily, they won't get you the three stars. But at least you get your paper out there. That was part of it, too. You get it out there, and then you're open to the criticism. So that's a good way to get science out there, and then you're not blocked by some reviewer that's a competitor, more or less. But they might be a little harsh on fine. But they got to be justified, right? Otherwise, they're putting themselves on the line, too. So good things to think about. This one would have been a good one online, I think, like eLife, because there's, you know, debate going on in this topic here. It would be interesting to see people's response to some of this. All right. So, like you said, there's, you know, some issues about maybe the way these people have done their experiments before, like you said, permeabilizing tissue. Let's start with this structure here. So the idea is, why is there still some tension? Why are things not following the, you know, tension length curves the way that everybody might assume they would, and that there were some anomalies that people had found in different labs? And, you know, maybe it's some of these different conditions on the experiment, and how could you justify these differences that people have found? So this is somewhat what we were talking about before, and like you mentioned, I think, earlier, about drugs that can bind differently to the myosin head and actually maybe change the distance and how these are working. So if we look at this schematic of this actin binding interface for the myosin head here, can you see that? And then the lever arm, and then identifying these different groups of proteins like the U50 and this L50, the bending part of the arm, and then kind of this diagram that comes about understanding how that head moves and the different parts of this about coming off the actin binding, but then just a little bit, and then it takes the phosphate to come off, and then the whole head can come off, right? So how these different steps in the myosin head binding to the actin and then coming off that actin in a sequential matter, and maybe that has really a part to do with the tension development curve that's seen. So it's putting it into a nice model again, and then looking at this, the myosin heads and the actin binding interface again over here, we can see this power stroke that's beginning to form, right? And then after the power stroke, that arm is more flattened out, linear in that aspect. So then it shouldn't have that tension development. So going through those steps, which we kind of generally went over a long time ago, about the ATP binding and then the head being able to come off a little bit, but it takes until that phosphate completely comes off before that head can completely detach. So this is what people are looking at. And we can go back to where they started to understand this. So just a few main points here. There's this little cleft that's there, and it's called this 50 kilodalton cleft, which is largely conforms to the strut and that switch two joints that we looked at, results in this increased affinity of the strong binding of the myosin to the actin, which changes the position of that lever arm. So they're looking at that unit right there in that switch two joint, and how that then changes the affinity. So then that could be a little bit of a tension development until it comes off completely. Seems a bit detailed here. So what they're looking at on these cross-bridge model with these three states of the myosin head is, one, this cross-bridge weakly binds to the actin. So here's a weak binding. Pre-power stroke, they call that. And then the cross-bridge strongly binds to the actin. This is the post-stroke, right? It has to be strong enough to then have that contraction and pull that actin around. So a real strong attachment there. And then the detached state. So they're looking at these three states: the weak binding, the strong binding, stroke, and then the head coming off to be able to then bend back and then bind again. So the idea is generally described, and we can kind of go through this. It's neat that they've gone through this step by step and really spelled it out nicely. One ATP molecule binding to the motor domain of the myosin and the subfragments and forcing that disassociation from the actin filament. And then this ATPase, which is in this S1, cleaves the ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate. And at this step, the PI is held in the myosin head, so it's still there. And it changes its conformation, right? Everything's conformational change. So the lever increases its angle and point of the myosin head towards the actin filament. And then the last step is after the myosin actin binding, the PI is liberated from the S1, triggering the power stroke. The myosin head moves and slides the actin filament towards the M line of the sarcomere. So as soon as that P is taking off, then that power stroke and it's ready to be taken off of that. And that last step is that ADP is released from the myosin, right? And it goes back into its initial conformation. So it takes until that ADP, I think I said earlier the PI, but it's the ADP has to be released, and then the myosin head can go back to the initial conformation. So they're looking at what's responsible for these different forces related to these different steps, and that might explain some of the differences that people had in some of their findings. So I think we've already talked about Titan and passive forces, right? Spans that Z line all the way to the M line. And what were some of the problems they had here? They were thinking also about the calcium binding that might have an effect with the Titan, the tension that Titan develops. And so that was an interesting point that they're addressing here as well. I thought this was interesting. I didn't know that before. That it's longer in Titan's longer in skeletal muscle. These domains are longer in skeletal muscle than in cardiac muscle. So that might be the reason for some of these length differences. And that slow muscle expresses a longer form of Titan than the fast muscle. So explaining some of those sarcomere banding patterns that we see in the lengths of sarcomeres might really have to do with some of the Titan lengths. And let's see, what did they find here? There was something interesting about this point. Oh, that maybe these shorter domains of the I-band to Titan behave as these springs regions of the Titan. All right, we talked about like little coils that are in there. And here's a nice picture of the Titan together with the Z line and the Titan coming in all the way to the M line. And then this is the actin band that's in here. And so talking about these different structures and these different lengths of these different domains then give rise to the different length of the whole Titan molecule together. So pretty neat. And that Titan has calcium binding sites on this PEVK domain. So does calcium have some role in maybe changing the conformation of Titan? So that could be a factor. And I think this is pretty neat. Nice picture if you're using this for later on, the whole band, the myosin filaments, the actin filaments from here to here. Pretty nice. Okay. So we kind of went over this general pattern here. Let's see. There was something interesting here. Oh, that I think when they start to address these differences too, like you were mentioning, different animals as well, right? So if you're using a frog muscle versus a mouse muscle or rat muscle, the differences that you might find, and the human muscle as well, right? And so these are differences, whereas like this Drosophila line, you can get a pretty isogenic line, but then you have different mice models as well. Yes?
Yeah, it was interesting. The paper someone brought up, I think, last week, that they did at Ball State with that sprinter, mm-hmm. there were differences in like the gene and protein expression of some of the fast isoforms. Mm-hmm. But when they did the single fiber testing, they saw like greater heterogeneity with like the unloaded contraction kinetics and max power output within those single fibers of the world class athlete than they even did with just the gene and protein expression. So mm-hmm. not only did they have more of the fibers, those fibers were way outperforming
those of the others. that's neat, because then you think about maybe these little differences,
yeah,
you know.
And there's a lot of work going on, like, in humans to figure out what is it about a certain fiber that allows it to contract more rapidly, even if it's the same isoform.
Yeah. And then that's where they get into, you know, really not just the genes, because maybe it's, you know, post-translationally modified. It's the protein structure itself, which then would be interesting to look at. Definitely. Good points. So lots of different things to think about with all this. In this part here, they're looking about the frog, for example, in those force-length relationships. And here they had, let's see, maximum forces between the sarcomere lengths of 1.6 microns to 3 microns. And that they got, you know, a little bit of varies a little between this maximum overlap and half maximal overlap, only to 50%. But that if they, let's see, average sarcomere length 3.4, only 10% of the cross bridges should be overlapping. So why do they have such a maximum force with such a few overlapping myosin heads? So these are the kind of the questions that were coming up about if you had more myosin heads attaching to the actin, then you should have a greater force, right? But it doesn't always, it's not always fitting with some of their models. So this is where some of the questions were coming up about these force relationships. So forces of 20% maximum values were observed when the sarcomere lengths were 3.8 to 4 microns, where conceptually the force should not be produced. So if they have these really stretched out and there's not an overlap of the myosin heads on the actin, why do they still have this force? You know, and so these are the models that should be able to be explained with the force development. So these are some of the questions that they're having. And then to address this in other animals as well, limulus, these are horseshoe crabs, right? So this is a whole other beast. And it's not really a crab. It's kind of one of these weird animals. They think it really might belong to the arachnoids, more of a spider-like family than a real true crab. So other things to think about, too, is kind of an unusual beast. They repeated these same observations and doesn't fit this classic force-length relationship as well. So, you know, why are there these differences? And some of this comes about that there's some really interesting aspects that we should think about is that the sarcomere lengths might be, you know, shorter at the ends in the intact muscle fiber than in the middle, right? So it's not all uniform across the whole muscle. You might have these different bandings or sarcomere lengths at ends of the muscle than in the middle, too, so that if you're just looking at the middle, then it doesn't relate to what might be happening at the ends of these muscles. So that's kind of an interesting point. So that might account for some of these differences. But this their point here was that this only results in small differences in these sarcomere lengths. They can lead to some large changes in the force and activation of the whole muscle fiber. So if we're thinking of these ends, they could add up and really maybe account for some of these differences that one's measuring actually in the total force. And the idea, too, is here that maybe these stronger sarcomeres will shorten and the weaker ones might be actually pulled apart. So it's not all uniform across the whole muscle contraction. And that's kind of an interesting point. And some, I think we talked a little bit about the barnacle muscle. There's some interesting aspects about that contracting differently as well on the whole muscle when they look at it. That there's some differences there, too, that you might actually see some sarcomeres stretching out where other ones are contracting. But anyways, this is interesting that that could be part of the cause for this problem as well. So it depends where one might be looking. Okay. So some other aspects, this passive force length relationship, we talked about that, like the Titan, right? And integrins too, plasma membrane, all that extracellular matrix might actually contribute somewhat to this. And they found that possibly there's some evidence about the calcium effects with the Titan. So there's some mounting evidence about calcium effects of force produced in the non-cross-bridging structure, changing that passive force relationship too, because remember, there were some binding spots to the Titan as well for calcium. And this is interesting. There's different ways that they tried to address this. And I think when Ken comes, he might be talking about maybe we should ask him to talk about this. that mice, the heads of the myosin coming back and forth but not binding, and that the structure, we can prelude them to this, that pepperin, does anybody remember when he talked about pepperin, what's in black pepper? It's supposedly the heads, the ATPase is burned up, right, but they don't bind strongly, so it can actually cause increased metabolism, and that then burns energy for the body, and then you could actually lose weight by possibly that. But that was kind of interesting that pepperin changes that. Do you remember any more about it?
He was talking about the super relaxed state.
Yes.
Yeah. Pepperin can make the head shift in and out of that state. So yeah. Out of that state more often than burning more ATP.
Okay. Yeah. So it doesn't bind really right to the actin, just stays and just uses ATP back and forth, but it doesn't completely bind and cause contraction. So interesting. Maybe he'll talk a little bit about that. So, new idea. So, eat a lot of black pepper if you want to lose weight. Maybe this is the idea, right? So, pepperin also blocks stretch-activated ion channels at different concentrations. So, I wonder, you know, how these might have other effects, too. Interesting. Lots of different aspects. Does anybody use bleibostatin in their experiments here? Anybody ever use it? Supposedly, it uncouples actin and myosin, and then you can't get muscle contraction. I just wonder if anybody uses this. And they call it bleibostatin because it actually makes bleebs on the cell membrane. It's a little, you know, like swellings, like little balloons on the membrane. But they also found out that it uncouples myosin and actin. So if one wanted to maybe address, you know, some aspects with that, that might be an idea to utilize. Peak calcium, you know, so they were looking at these different calcium levels in Ken, we asked Ken to explain a little bit more about peak calcium, because the lower the number, that means higher calcium, right? Anybody remember all that stuff? And maybe not, but all right, so Ken will talk about that. That can be a little confusing at first. So the higher the number, it's actually lower calcium. So what they found in these aspects with calcium relationship is that, let's see, 350% in the sarcomere length at 6 microns after myofibrils are stretched in different calcium levels. So they found a different ability for these muscles to, let's see, what did they say? Remarkably different than others. In this study, the authors observed the increase in force of 350% in the sarcomere length at 6 microns after the myofibrils are stretched in this higher calcium as compared to the lower calcium. So that's the take home. I wouldn't worry about the numbers so much. But they found that the tension to be different in the high calcium than the low calcium. All right, so the lower number is actually higher calcium than this peak calcium here. Okay, so they proposed some new ideas. And this is actually some ideas that we've heard last year, too, about even the Titan that might wind differently because of the spring component in the Titan, that might actually give some tension to the muscle as well. So their results have been used in the proposal of this new paradigm of muscle contraction, the winding or winding filament theory, two, and contraction. It is known that these muscle fibers are stretched as little as 20% from the plateau of the force-length relationship get inversely damaged. So if you overstretch them too much, then they get this damage, so that they normally don't function in that in some of these ranges that people might do experimentally. All right, what else was this take home here? I think that's not so bad. Just some ideas out there. And these were kind of interesting about looking at different... I don't know if you had a chance to look at any of these figures here. About sarcomere lengths, and then looking at the force, relative force differences, and at if they... some of these relationships that didn't fit well with what one might expect. Let's go back to this calcium one first. This might be interesting. So here's the sarcomere lengths and the force that they're measuring. And if they increase the calcium, you can see that the whole length curve would change for each one of these fibers that they're looking like. This would change that much. This would change that much. This would change that much. This one changes that much. So there's something to maybe this calcium that is causing this increase in tension that's at the same length that they have, that you got this increase in tension. So this is where the questions are coming up about how calcium might be enrolled in this as well, and that you might have these different relationships. It's not just the myosin heads overlapping with the actin, but some other factors that could be related as well. So let's see what else was happening here. Oh, so this is where, let's see, this was an interesting part. This graph here, the point at which the myofibrils yield in tightness dislodged from the A-band, this is this trace, this vertical line, so tightened becomes dislodged if you overstretch this, so that might actually change some aspects too if one's going too far and you actually get muscle maybe damage from this where you can't really have the overlap anymore, but you're still getting this passive force that can be generated. And it's more than this active force that one could generate by overlapping the myosin with the actin filaments. But this graph is a little confusing to me here. I don't really...
That's your descending.
This, what is this again?
Descending.
This is... Oh, so when they're coming off of that and then stretching it?
His argument is that at 4 micrometers, there should be no overlap between that optic and fin during isometric contraction and rotation.
Okay. Right there.
Then if you activate and pull all the way through, you'll get those red dots or those blue dots.
Okay, but then over here, there's no more overlap, right?
Exactly.
And so why do we get this is basically it. And this is the passive. You know, so this is all the passive, what is thought to be all the passive parts and maybe a muscle?
That'll be passive, but then there's also the argument that you get 450%, 300% greater force eccentrically during an active contraction when you also pull out the 6 micrometers.
Oh, okay. This is the whole part about that. All right. So that's kind of that's interesting.
Yeah. You know, if I could add to what you said a moment ago about the models and used in these experiments physiologically as well as mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
The model you choose is really, really, really important when it comes to the interpretation of the results and to compare them with the results. But that figure you had right there.
Oh, yes. This one's interesting.
The most of that work up there is 1961 to 1978.
Wow.
Especially the top five curves, Tekster curves, Chechi and Fabiano, all these great mechanics papers from the past. They were done a long time ago and the methods weren't quite as good.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to keep in mind that, and I'm going to clarify this more on Wednesday too, everybody in the lab, but the force mass relationship of muscle based mathematically and mechanically on a single sarcopenic one, myosin is an active. And you know, you're talking about something that's 3.5 micrometers in length and 2 micrometers in diameter. Mathematically, what the force mass relationship is supposed to be has been extrapolated out to an entire muscle. And that's a lot of sarcopenes in parallel, a lot of sarcopenes in series, a lot of connective tissue in their nerves, and their tendons. And depending on how you want to measure that force-length property, you will get various different kinds of responses based on how much tissue is in the way or how you're actually doing it, whether it has, you know, there's the physiological aspects of contraction, there's a mechanical aspect of contraction. So those top curves that are very, very curvy represent fibers, whole fibers, with thousands of sarcopenes, millions of sarcopenes in series, you're trying to extrapolate down to what one is actually
doing.
And when we do force length in humans, you'll always get curves like those top ones. They don't follow this nice perfect little delineation because it's an average. A whole lot of sarcopenic lines. A whole lot of forces all put together. And so trying to get a perfect sarcopenic force length relationship has only been done in one lab vaccine with a single sarcopenic plate.
Wow.
In which they clamped the myofibril point they measured with one of the sarcopenes.
Was it like with laser tweezers or something, or no?
It was with a myofibril setup, so it was a series of sarcopenes in series. So the only thing a myofibril has is just the protein lattice for a frame.
Oh,
so
okay. There
you removed everything else, including any sort of tendon, but you have tightened myosin, tightened actin myosin, and all the attachment proteins that the dentist is like. So there you just drop calcium, et cetera, in there, and it will contract, and you put in a relaxing solution, it will relax.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim was able to clamp at the deadlines of one sarcomere and then measure the whole time.
That's
there's
pretty good.
There's a lot of limitations around it, too.
Yeah.
There's a natural limitation.
But pretty cool.
And it gets a lot closer to what Huxley's original idea
was. Yeah, perfect. So, like in these experiments, maybe tying off the two tendons
exactly.
is a big problem. Versus,
yeah, you know, they try to say it's a force point because they try to use a spot follower device and put it on a series of deadlines. You know, try to have a servo motor that when these deadlines start to move, because all tissues creep, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, and the muscle motor will relax and they'll move out or in and try to keep those deadlines where they're supposed to be. And that's how they're saying we have a sarcoid length of 3.5.
Yeah.
But within there, their beams are so big, there's 400, 500 sarcoids between them.
Yeah.
They're all jockeying in the position.
So, and then those different lengths. So that's pretty much the gist of trying to figure out all these differences, right? So let's see what we've got here. Okay, we've got a few minutes. So I guess it's the same point about what we were just covering, too. And here's some key elements I just tried to highlight while we've got some time here. Intact fibers isolated from the mouse showed that the static stiffness is greater in some of these, like these fast muscles, than in the slow muscle as well. And so maybe it's the thickness of that muscle and all those other components we were just talking about, and the whole muscle, right? So that's kind of neat. All right, let's see, where else were we? Oh, so some of these, increasing the load and stretching the fibers, maybe we can get more into that later, or even on Wednesday, right? Some of the mechanisms for accounting for these differences might be the force enhancement during the stretch has been attributed to an increase in the mean cross bridges force, or changes in the conformation of the attached cross bridges. Some references there, and an increase in number of the cross bridges attached to actin, or a combination of these, probably account for some of these differences like we were just mentioning, because it doesn't fit into that traditional aspect. All right, let's see. I think what you were mentioning before about these different drugs that can actually change the power stroke and maybe change that distance between the heads, that could be quite interesting as well. So different molecules like this BTS, which I'm not familiar with, but anyways, that could actually have differences in relationships of these heads binding. And let's see what else we have here. So here they actually showed that there was some reason for this. Although these studies suggest that the increase in force is caused by an increase in force of the actin-myosin state in the cross bridges, other people have rigorously measured by X-ray diffraction rising from the myosin layers have shown an increase in force accompanied by an increase in stiffness of 20 to 60% without apparent changes in the cross bridge mean force. So that something's going on here if you can get an increase in force but not changing the number of cross bridges that are on there. And so that's interesting point. And they think that maybe this mechanism is not completely understood. These cross bridges attached to actin is unclear. So some aspects to this. Another one is these engagement of a second cross bridge that might share with the myosin segment. So maybe even the conformation that I think Ken will get more into because he's built some really nice models. All right. I don't know if there was too much more with that, really. And there's something about, we had this last year, somebody was talking about this popping that was occurring. Does anybody remember that part about if you start to stretch the sarcomere, then all of a sudden you got this jump in the, you know, from the distance, right? And then it pops out. Anybody want to talk about that? Anybody remember? About the popping of the sarcomere force? No? Does Tim? Okay. Sure. Maybe you could talk a little bit about it? No?
Yeah, I can. It's an interesting hypothesis that's been around since 1989.
Okay.
Dave Morgan has a really interesting paper in 1990. He did a sabbatical from Monash University to Harvard. He worked with a guy named Harry. They're trying to mathematical models to better look at eccentric distractions and how the forces work on.
Okay.
And Dave Morgan is a computer engineer.
Okay.
neurologist, physiologist at the time, but he does a lot of computer modeling. He did a model for, or mechanical engineer, he did a model for two sarcoid receptors, actually.
Uh-huh.
And he had active myosin and did not put titan there because titan was what we all know.
Okay.
And the simple mathematical model, this computer model, showed that if the two sarcoids are different lengths, which they always are, right, and there's always fluctuation forces in length, that because of how cross-bridges should attach to actin and how much force should be there in a certain sarcoid, the one with the most force was going to contract, and the weaker one is going to stretch.
Mm-hmm.
And he then said, this is what happens in muscle.
All right.
Irrespective of the fact that he has modeled it, two proteins in it,
okay,
and two sarcoids. And so the idea is that whenever you have a load and a stretch of a muscle, that the stronger sarcoids would always be stronger, so they would contract, and the weaker ones would be off.
Okay.
That's what we call popping.
That's the whole popping aspect. But it would be an abrupt change in the force and the tension.
And the idea was that if that happens most of the time.
Oh, okay.
That's how that works. That's how it forces. And then you have sarcoids that are so short and stronger and other ones that pop beyond overlap that your average sarcoid length would be large, but your forces would be higher because the sarcoids that are engaged are shorter.
Sure. Okay. That's cool. So the ideas are that they're trying to explain these differences in the force relationship with the structure of the sarcomere, and that some of this non-uniformity alone might, you know, couldn't explain all the extra force-stretch relationships, but that there's probably some other factors too. One of these is really these half sarcomeres that they can find, right? So that's kind of interesting too. It doesn't account for, you know, all the sarcomeres, and that might have a variability of the overlap that forms. And got a few minutes here. Finally, that maybe even this titan could really have quite an effect as well, unfold and refolding, and that titan might play an important role in these active force generation, as we just mentioned, even with the calcium binding, that could have an effect in enhancing tension. So, the take home on some of these deviations that they found with these force length relationships, and like we were already talking about different labs doing experiments differently, but the take home here are these three main points here. This non-uniformity of sarcomere lengths that happens naturally in single fibers increases upon activation and leads to this equilibrium state that produces a force that is larger than predicted by the average filament overlap. And just as we mentioned, these strong sarcomeres are supported by maybe some passive sarcomeres and the stiffness of titan itself, right? That could be part of the factor. And that we just mentioned about this segment in the titan and activation increases, shifts in the relationship might balance some of the force in the stretched sarcomeres with higher active force due to that increased filament overlap. And maybe that's even part of it, the differences in these different muscle fibers, because these different lengths of these segments that are inside titan. If muscles are stretched upon activation, there's an increase in the non-uniformity of the half sarcomere lengths, so again, overlapping, which changes the overlap of these filaments, and an increase in force produced by titan, which might be stiffer due to the calcium, so that these other models might not have included these kind of factors, which now could explain some of these deviations that you have in the force-length relationships that weren't previously put into that single sarcomere pattern. There's always other factors to consider. So I know we didn't cover every little detail in this paper, but generally I think we get the take-home, right, is there are a lot of other factors besides just those single sarcomere to consider. Is that okay? Anybody want to add something to that? I know it's a little boring just to read the paper directly to you, but, you know, hitting these main points to make sure that we kind of get these down. All right. Good. Interesting. Yes. Exciting. New things to think about. You can come up with new models. You might describe something new. Who knows? Think out of the box. You know, it's good. I mean, it's good that these people have thought about some other ideas that didn't relate to it, and then people could go back and readdress it, right? That's the power of science. Make predictions. See what happens, hypothesize, postulate, right? And then let it be torn apart and then see if it really holds or not. And that's really the beauty of science. And, you know, you got to be thick-skinned sometimes and accept that maybe you were wrong and go with it, right? That's part of it. Good. All right, so Wednesday, where are we meeting?
We're meeting in the Weddington Building.
222. Right, okay. So see you there. Yep, thank you.
Then you say yes,
that's why. Yeah. Anything for you.